Let's pick up this morning on the 13th chapter and a verse, the 8th verse, that really could be a problem to us if we think that Scripture can mean only one thing, is always literal, and can have only one meaning. This says in my translation, "Be in debt to no one. The only debt that you should have is to love one another." The old King James is, "Owe no man anything." And here I stand with the Bank of America or the MasterCard, all these symbols of debt in which we live our lives. Now, what is the great apostle saying to graced people about how they are to relate to others? It seems like to me that the issue here that we need to face, and it again goes back to something that I have tried to work with before, this whole business of need love versus gift love, that what he's really saying to us here is that we need to be very careful how we become dependent on other people. And it seems like to me that it would be consistent with what Paul has been saying in the book of Romans, that if we will let the gift love of Yahweh God be the primal source out of which we allow our basic needs to be met. In other words, I as a creature am filled with all kinds of needs that inheres in my condition. But how I go about meeting my needs, the contracts that I strike of dependency, can go a whole long way to either making me enslaved or can contribute to my being set free. And I have found that when I really do turn to gift love and grace, as it is mediated through other human beings, through the Christian community, through the whole grace of creation, when I really attempt to let my basic human needs be met from that source, then that frees me to be a gift giver and a gift lover to the other parts of creation that I find myself in touch with. On the other hand, if I get almost chronically and panically dependent on other people, or institutions, or whatever, if I don't rely on grace to meet my needs, but rather if I rely on some institution or some other person, then I run in the very grave danger of being in bondage. I run the danger of depending on something that is not able to deliver. And therefore, I think he is saying that in the deepest sense of obligation, you would be best served if you would look to gift love as the ultimate source of the meeting of your needs. And I don't mean by this an isolated, vertical, pious relation that doesn't realize that God mediates most of his stuff to us through other people or through institutions or through the creation. But if you will finally depend for your very life and needs on the gift-giving God, that will free you then to have one main agenda as you turn to other people. And that is to try as best you can to give what you have got to meet the needs of other people, not with a lot of strings attached to it, not with a lot of expectations that you are making on these people because you're loving them. But if we will let God give love and meet our needs, that frees us then to turn to others and not be so needy in the way we relate to them that we really can give. We really do not live or die in terms of whether or not they accept us. We really don't turn over the crucial defining of our existence to anybody else but the one who knows us best because he's created us, loves us most because he is by nature gift love. That is the one on whom to depend leads to freedom rather than to bondage. I heard Keith Miller ask one time, "Who is your audience?" What he was getting at here, I think, was that we all play our lives to some significant group. There's always some group or some person whose approval really does matter to us. And depending on who our audience is, we are either going to be free to live out of our own enthusiasms and individuality, believing that the audience really does affirm what we are and our uniqueness and wants that to come to flower. Or if our audience is someone or some institution that has a very rigid range of expectations and likes, then we're going to have to cut ourselves down and do what it is that we think that audience wants? It's a very profound question. To whom are you playing your life? Whose approval really does matter? I worked in a church one time where there was a musician. This is a long time ago. I was just the assistant minister. And there was a musician in the church who had been taught by an Episcopal organist who was also operating in the city. And I had the feeling that every service that was put together in this church by this musician was put together with the idea that if Bleep Bleep happened to come by and pick up one of the bulletins, what would he think of the quality of music that was being used in the service? Now, the trouble was that the rest of us there were not as sophisticated in our taste as was this Episcopal organist. But this man, I don't think he was even conscious of it, but he was really doing his work professionally with this kind of audience in view, and that meant that he, in a sense, was in bondage. He was really not free to serve the people that were before him, and maybe not even free to give vent to some of the things that were in him that didn't happen to be in that organist. All I'm saying is that if somebody else, if their approval is absolutely determinative for you, if you owe them that kind of allegiance, then you're going to be limited according to their limits, because there are very few individuals that know you in the fullness of your uniqueness or esteem and value your uniqueness. They may have their own stuff that they want to put on you. Therefore, the question, who is your audience? I heard Robert Raines raise the same issue under a different image when he said once, who gives you your grade? To whom do you submit the paper of your life, and whose evaluation is really important to you? Okay, I'm trying to suggest that if we really do, as Bob Norman said last night, a la Kierkegaard, if we really do our lives with the sense that God is the audience, it's a very profound and, I think, right interpretation of public worship, that the worshiper is the prime actor, God is the audience. All that we do in worship, we do before God, in relation to God, in terms of what we can do, in terms of reacting to Him. And the clergy and the choir are prompters, producers, enablers. It's a very right view of worship. It is not like going to the theater. It's very easy for us to forget in this great celebrity age that we live in. But my point is that if God is your audience, if He really is the one whose approval you are most concerned about, if He is the one to whom you look in the getting of your grade, then that is going to be the most freeing, the most creative of all the kinds of dependencies that we can establish. We as creatures have to live a great portion of our lives in terms of need love. But if you will depend on God, if you will owe no man, no woman, any ultimate kind of allegiance, that will free you to love them and to serve them. It will also free you to get on with the business of being the unique thing that you are. I don't think anybody else has as much freedom to give you as God does, and nobody knows you quite like the one who made you, and nobody loves you quite as much as the one who looked on your creation and broke out in delight. He was really pleased with what He did when He made you. And reconciliation is not getting God to like us. That's what the pagans always thought, that they had to get God somehow reconciled to them. Reconciliation is our becoming reconciled to the good thing that God has made and coming to feel about the event of our creation the way God feels about it. And that's the kind of obligatory relationship that frees instead of tyrannizes. So, oh, no human being ultimate allegiance. Duffy Darty, when he decided to step down as football coach at Michigan State, is reputedly to have said, the trouble with being a football coach is you're responsible to irresponsible people. And that is, you're ultimately depending on that which can't be ultimately depended upon. Okay, I think that's what the great apostle is saying. Put all your weight and hope in another person or another institution, and you're going to be disappointed and tyrannized. Okay, then he goes on to address what I think is a very real contemporary issue today. on the college campuses, given the mood of much present Christian teaching and methodology. And he talks here about the relation of rules and principles and prescriptions that exist outside ourselves that get spoken into us over against the internalizing of a kind of spirit that enables one to do Christian life not in a kind of lockstep to external commands that are being beamed in, but it talks about finally coming to the place where the spirit that is the very essence of the Christian faith gets so internalized that we are doing something out of what we are and are not simply having to mechanically follow rules that are being given to us from outside. Whoever loves his fellow man or fellow woman has obeyed the law. The commandments, do not commit adultery, do not murder, do not steal, do not covet, all of these and any others beside are summed up in the one commandment, love your fellow human being as yourself. Whoever loves his fellow human being will never do him wrong. To love, then, is to obey the whole law. I think it's very important that we get clearly in mind that rules do have a very important place in our coming of age as human persons. Rules are, as St. Paul says in another place, the schoolmaster of Christ. They are the kindergarten, the beginning place, the utterly essential foundation to learning how to do something. And therefore, I am not saying this morning that the four spiritual laws are all of the enormous rule-giving that goes, say, with the Bill Gothard Institute. I am not saying that all of that is of no value, that all of that is something that is antithetical to gospel, because I see it as an enormously important stage along the way toward Christian maturity. Everybody, when they don't know anything about a process, has to start by being taught externally by somebody who knows more than they do. If I want to learn to play the piano, I have to begin with the scales, and I have to begin with somebody speaking out of their fullness to my emptiness. And therefore, rules and the law are always the schoolmaster, the beginning stage, and we ought to understand that and not to scorn it. To think that you can jump over into instant maturity is to simply not accept the shape of our life in history. So the four spiritual laws, all of the rules, the prescriptions, the ways that other people have of describing to you how to begin to act, how to begin to think, in order to come to a certain goal, those have a tremendous importance as the beginning, as the foundation of a process. But the ultimate goal of the Christian life is not to be rule-oriented, it seems like to me. It seems like to me that Moses had a rightful place in the economy. He was the lawgiver, the one through whom the instructions first came. But Jesus Christ came, I think, to finally bring the vision and the reality that is spelled out in one form in the law. He came to give this such an infusion of spirit into our lives that we were finally having come to be so intimately united with the spirit of love that instead of in every situation having to stop and say, now where in the yellow pages, you know, is the rule? Here I am in this situation. Now what did the master back here tell me to do? Utterly appropriate for beginners. That's the place to begin. That is not the place to end. The goal, I think, is to finally get what the law is about so internalized, get the principles are so digested and therefore diffused into our consciousness, that what we finally do is get to the place that we no longer have to think left foot, right foot, you know, when we're trying to walk. We're past that. There comes finally a habituating, a soul infusing and an internalizing of the kinds of things that the law is really trying to produce in us. So that what starts out as a principle and is largely external finally becomes such a part of our own reality as Christ ceases to be someone who simply tells us in rule form what to do and becomes our living companion, yea, the very center of our personhood, so that the duet the dance that I talked about the other day really does become the basic way that you feel life is, and it's the very basic way that you do life. So you can go with a kind of confidence and a kind of freedom into every situation and believe that as that situation arises, having been sensitized by principles and having been sensitized by what the law can do, and therefore having one's perception shaped in that way, you can go to act freely, you can trust spontaneity. You no longer have to go into every situation kind of feeling like a puppet that is ultimately being controlled manually from somewhere else. But the spirit of the whole thing that we're into finally gets internalized, it gets inside us, and we begin to do this not out of a spirit that, okay, what am I being told to do, but here is what, lo and behold, the Christ within is actually moving, leading me to do. Now, I don't know that we ever get perfectly mature in this way. I don't think we ever get beyond the place that we don't have to go back and refresh our perspective with the law. The law continues to be a foundation. Yet I would suggest to you that the children's story of Pinocchio is a very good model of what the maturing process is. Pinocchio, as you remember, was a wooden kind of doll that began the process of becoming human. I think that's what the writer is trying to describe in symbolic ways, that we start out largely as simply objects, and we become persons gradually. Okay, Pinocchio, first of all, gets a measure of personhood, but he still doesn't have the kind of wisdom within him that knows how to react to reality rightly. And Jiminy Cricket, you may remember, is the conscience figure in the story. And as long as Jiminy Cricket is sitting on his shoulder and telling Pinocchio what to do, that they get along pretty well. But whenever Pinocchio gets away, gets separated from Jiminy Cricket, then Pinocchio gets into these awful, awful scrapes. Okay, the Jiminy Cricket's great desire is to try to lead this one till he finally knows how to act in ways that are not destructive of himself or others. And he says at one point in the story, if I could only get inside of Pinocchio, you know, if I could only get inside him so everywhere he goes, I could go, and we didn't have this problem of being spatially separated, you know, then Jiminy Cricket and Pinocchio could become a collaborative team. The wisdom and the power could get together in an inseparable way. Now, that is the goal, I think, of Christian maturity. When what the law teaches us as to how we are to use our lives becomes so internalized and so much a part, not just of what other people are saying to it, but it makes so much sense to us. It's just like the food that we eat finally becomes indistinguishable with the rest of our own corpus, that the goal of the Christian life, the goal of all these commandments, don't kill, don't commit adultery, don't steal, can really be summed up in one reality. If I really finally get to the place that my whole being is suffused by gift love, if I realize that that is the image in which I am made, that gift love is what God is and gift love is what He really wants me to get into, this is the way He wants me to live my life. Need love, I remind you, is that sense of emptiness that always sees in other things that which it needs. And therefore, the roots of all lust, the roots of all greed, the roots of envy are all born in a sense of inner emptiness. I don't have it. Somebody or something else does have it. And so my need love, though it may look and sound like affection, is really a way of my emptiness reaching out to some kind of fullness and getting hold of some of that and bringing it back to my emptiness. It's a way of acquiring, a way of extracting, a way of getting something from somebody else that I perceive I need. This is a bottomless pit kind of process. Need love never does finally, I don't think, answer the great hunger that is within. Most need love experiences, I think, could be symbolized with something that happened to me when I was about 5. I had a favorite uncle who didn't have any children and loved to take me to football games and special events. My father traveled, was out of town most of the time, and so this man was, in many ways, kind of surrogate father to me. He took me to my first state fair in Nashville when I was 5. School had just started, I remember. It was still hot. I went into the midway at the fairgrounds there in Nashville and saw for the first time in my life an absolutely delectable-looking entity that my uncle named Cotton Candy. And I said, as you would expect a child to say, "Can I have some?" He, being dutifully anxious to, you know, give me what I wanted, bought me some. And I can still remember the great anticipation I had, that the wonder of getting in touch with something new that looked beautiful. I remember tasting that cotton candy, and without doubt, that was the most intense experience of sweetness I have ever had ever up to that time experienced. It was really absolutely beyond description. But just when I was getting ready to really get my mouth around it and savor it and enjoy it, lo and behold, I tasted and my mouth was empty. There was nothing but air. There was that intense moment of sweetness, and then dadgone, I didn't have anything left. Now, I suggest to you that a whole lot of our need-loving is going to have that kind of character to it, that we see something and we say, "I've got to have that." And we taste it, and it is exquisitely sweet for a moment, and then all of a sudden, there is the emptiness and the hunger, you know, that has to be fed all over again. And that's true of a lot of sensual experiences. I have heard people, when they're really honest, talk about their first sexual experience and how profoundly disappointed they were after all of this built-up hope. You know, after Hugh Hefner has told us that this is going to be the end-all, be-all, end-all, that this is really where it's at forever and ever, and that terrific build-up and all that anticipation and that moment of overwhelming ecstasy, and then the emptiness, the all to be done over again, the having to get up from the table hungry. Okay, need love, as real as it is to our humanness, in its very sense of emptiness and in its over-expecting, I think, of what others can really give that will meet the primal hungers, it's an acquisitive process, and it always, it seems like to me, winds up again in emptiness, and the same thing has to be done. Gift love, I would remind you, is born of a sense of fullness. It regards that which is beyond itself as a value to be enhanced. There is intrigue. There is the desire to take our resources and make them available for the growing and blessing and healing of something else. Gift love is born out of a great desire to create value and not to extract value back to yourself. Gift love is a way of building up and not sucking out or tearing down. And God's whole creation, it seems like to me, can be defined as a gift love operation. And I come to the fullness of my own humanness when I realize that what I owe to everybody, what I really and truly owe to you, is to give you whatever it is that I have, that I want to give, that can help you on your journey and help you to grow. I can't do a lot of things for you. The band of what one human being can do for another is very, very narrow. And realize that. We can't give each other the will to live. Most of the problems that you're facing are not problems I can solve for you. They're problems you're going to have to solve yourself. Most of the questions that you're answering, I can only give you my partial answers. You're going to have to find the things that make for your peace. The band of what any human being can do for another is very, very narrow. But at the same time, there are crucial things that I can make available to you that if, at the teachable moment, I'm willing to give them and you're willing to receive them, it can enormously enhance and get you on your journey. And that's what I owe you. And if I can get this spirit of gift love into me, then really and truly the negative laws and the last part of the Decalogue of the Ten Commandments are largely impulse control kinds of injunctions. They tell us not to commit adultery, not to murder, not to steal, not to covet, which is the way you have to start out with a child. You have to start curbing all of this energy before you can start channeling it. Okay, if I can ever get gift love internalized, if Jiminy Cricket can ever get inside Pinocchio, if Holy Spirit, living Christ, resurrected Christ, can ever get inside of me, then if I really do have gift love at the center of my perspective, then you don't have to tell me not to commit adultery with a person if I love that person. You don't have to tell me don't rip somebody off if I love them. You know, those are things that simply go with the territory. So the great goal is to take the law, the principles, whatever it is that is being taught externally. The goal is not simply to leave them in external legalistic form, but the goal is to eat the law, that is, to get the law inside you. And I think one of the ways of describing what this kind of internalizing process actually does is the way my great mentor, Carl Armani, who just died about 6 weeks ago, he used to translate, you know, that if you will give yourself to God, that he will give you the desires of your heart. He used to say that what that really means is he will fix your water. And I really do like that. That's what it means to internalize the law. There will finally come the time, as Jeremiah says, that you won't have to say to people, do this and don't do that, but the law will have become written on the heart. And when it becomes written on the heart, he will fix your water. What it is that you come to desire and what it is that you come to be attracted to will actually bear the mark of the risen Christ. And that is the goal toward which we move. Now, I hope I'm being clear. I have a lot of people that I've worked with who have been enormously helped by going to the Bill Gothard Institutes. And I think part of what is so enormously helpful is that he is so specific. You know, no novitiate going into a Jesuit seminary would have his life detailed more carefully for him than a Bill Gothard Institute. There in one book, you know, there are rules for everything. There are rules for the minutest kinds of behavior. Now, as a place to begin, I think it is enormously valuable. I have seen people who are so confused, that is, in their own experience, their lives are in such a jumble, that they really don't know how to get out of the bed and don't know which foot to put in front of the other when they get out of the bed. I'm speaking now metaphorically. But they are so confused in their personal and family relationships that for somebody to come along and give them a model of what to do is enormously helpful. If you're totally lost and somebody comes and says, I can't tell you how to get to your ultimate goal, but if you will simply go to this filling station and ask, they can tell you. To just know one thing to do in the midst of your confusion is enormously helpful. So the Bill Gothard thing, in my judgment, does give one a pattern by which one can begin to act specifically. I have the fear, though, that if you stay in that kind of legalistic house, if you depend for the rest of your life on having that book or going back periodically to get recharged by the same system of rules, that if you end there, that you will be less than the high and noble thing that God meant for you to be. Because we have to start with rules, but that's not, it seems like to me, where the Christian life is intended to end. And I think that those of us who are in the business of giving guidance to students have to be terribly careful that we don't get to enjoying the role of telling people what to do and modeling their lives for them. I go back again, I think I've referred to it, that when the prodigal son came back home, he was in this state of confusion I've described. He had made such a botch of it out there in the far country. He had found out that he knew so little about how to decide things and do things. The money that his father had been smart enough to make and save, he had been dumb enough to lose out there. All that big talk that he had given to everybody at home about what he was going to do when he got out there and got away from this crappy little place where nobody knew how to live, all that big wind that he had let go about what he was going to do had all come to naught. He wasn't nearly as wise as he thought he was. Okay, he comes home swinging to the other extreme. He wanted total freedom. I didn't want any freedom at all. Make me a hired servant. Daddy, let me climb back in your lap. Mama, let me back in your womb. Very predictable reactions to crashing into reality in adolescence. You know, back in the 60s, the great pattern was for alienated adolescents to leave home, and you never heard from them again. In fact, they were whole places that were developed in the 60s to try to recover and try to get in touch with adolescents that had just disappeared. But they say now that the great trend is for people to leave for a while and then come back home, and you can't get them to leave a second time. That now the problem is, what do you do after they've had one run at life and it's really turned out to be complicated, and they're satisfied to come home and live again as children? Okay, the great fear I have of how the Bill Gotha thing can be misused is that there may be the tendency to want to come to that kind of thing and say, make me a hired servant. Tell me what to do, when to get up and when to go to bed. Take all this burden of decision-making off of me. I simply want to live my whole life out of a rule book, and you tell me what to do, and I will do it. And that's a good place to begin. It's a bad place to end. Is there anybody here that needs a equal time? I realize that I may not be completely fair to the Bill Gotha, though I have done a lot of thinking about it and lots of talking with people who have been through it. I hope I'm making clear that I really see its value, and I understand why it is so popular. And I think we, in our existential mood of the 60s, were so vague that many times people didn't have any sense of how to begin the Christian life. But all I'm trying to argue is that it seems like to me St. Paul is saying that the goal is to get love internalized. And love is something very concrete. Love is something very specific. Love is saying, in effect, what happens to you makes a difference to me, and I'm willing to make my resources available to your growing. I think that love is very, very specific. But the goal is to be so suffused with the Spirit of Christ and in the companionship of love incarnate that I can really walk into a situation and trust my own impulses as to what is the loving thing to do. Now, that would be very dangerous at the beginning of your Christian life. Joseph Fletcher's situational ethics, which I think got tragically distorted, and many people who've never read the book think what he means is just do whatever you want to, that what it means is that, just go with the wind, and that's not at all what he's saying. He is saying that there must be taken into account in decision-making what are the specific variables in that particular situation. There are no prescriptions that are equally and totally applicable to every situation. And maybe he overstated that. I think "don't be cruel" is an absolute. I really cannot think of any situation where cruelty is justified. And to be loving, as he says, he tried to say that the one absolute is that you always attempt to do the loving thing. And he defined the loving thing as asking what I think has to be asked of any moral decision, namely, what are the motives out of which this action is born? Why are you doing this? Are you doing this for yourself and your enhancement, or are you doing it for somebody else's enhancement? Therefore, what are my motives? Why am I doing it? And then the other thing is, what are the likely consequences that are going to come? Now, every time we act, we make a difference in the situation into which we insert our action. To act is to make a difference, to leave things other than they were before we came and before we acted. And therefore, if we will ask not only why am I doing this, but what is likely to happen if I do this or this or this or this, what are the likely consequences to come from this particular action? Then what the loving thing comes out is, I've got to say, love is when I use my resources to aid and abet your growing. That is the proper love motive. And the love consequence is, of all the things that I am capable of doing, what could I do that would bring the most good to the most people who will be touched, by this particular action? Now, a situational ethic is really going into every situation, bringing with me gift love, and asking that, why am I thinking about doing this? And if I did this, what would happen? If I did this, what would happen? If I did this, what would happen? And I think that that's a very, a very good model for decision making, and you need the risen Christ within you to help you process this. A 16-year-old in the back seat of a car, you know, with a girl or a boy, it probably doesn't have the equipment to go through all this elaborate process of what are my motives and what are the consequences, and therein is one of the problems and why the law really is important. At the beginning of your journey, you need a lot of rules, a lot of impulse control that is outside of you. But the goal is to so internalize that you'll get to the place that your computer knows what it's doing and can work fast, and you can pretty quickly assess why you're doing something, and what are the likely consequences to come. Now, I think it can also be said that the more people you take into account as you are trying to measure the impact of your actions, the more people you take into account, the more moral your act is. The fewer people you take into account, the less moral your act is. What I'm suggesting is that when we're saying, if I do this, what is its impact going to be? The wider you allow the circle of concern to go, the more moral your action is to become. At one end of the spectrum is John 3:16. God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son. God took everybody into account in deciding what he was going to do with Jesus. That is the most moral act ever done. At the other end of the spectrum are the thieves in Jesus' parable of the Good Samaritan, who fell on the man as he was going down from Jerusalem to Jericho, and seemingly they didn't have any concern whatsoever for what was going to happen to him. They wanted his goods. They beat him up. They left him by the side of the road. They stripped him of everything and simply left him without any regard whatsoever positively for the impact of their acts on him. Okay, here are your two extremes. When you don't take anybody else into account except yourself, and when you take everybody in the whole world into account. Well, now, we're not capable, let's face it, of this kind of love. There's nothing we do that's going to have an impact on everybody. But the more people you factor in as you are thinking about the consequences of your actions, the more people you take into consideration, the more moral your action becomes. The fewer people, the less moral it becomes. And if we can realize that love, give love, is the desire to use our stuff to enhance the life of another or the life of an institution, and let Christ internalize this, we begin to emerge into the free, serving, healing, a responsible persons and communities that we're supposed to be. In verse 11, we get into another issue that I think is alive on the campus today. That's this whole business of the second coming, of when history is going to be over, how quickly this is going to happen. He's saying now that you must get on with the business of internalizing love. You must do this because you know what hour it is. The time has come for you to wake up from your sleep. For the moment when we will be saved is closer now than when we first believed. The night is nearly over, the day is almost here. Let us therefore stop doing the things that belong to the dark and take up the weapons for fighting that pertain to the light. Let us conduct ourselves properly as people who live in the light of day. No orgies or drunkenness, no immorality, nor indecency, no fighting or jealousy, but take up the weapons of the Lord Jesus Christ. As the King James puts it, put ye on the Lord Jesus Christ, and stop giving attention to your sinful nature to satisfy its desires. Okay, I'm sure that late great planet Earth has made its way past you and your campus. At least I'd be surprised if it hasn't. There's a whole lot in the air today that would give the feeling that we are living in the last days, that any minute now, Christ is going to return, history is going to come to an end, the final judgment will take place. There are a variety of theories as to what will follow that. Will there be 1,000 years of reign of Christ historically? Will history as we know it come to an end? But the whole thing is that there's a lot in the air today that would lead you to think that history is about to come to its rightful consummation, and therefore we don't have forever. Okay, how are we to react to this? It seems like to me that St. Paul, he thought back in the first century that this thing, the coming of Christ, was imminent. He thought that they were living, as is obvious from what he said, in the next to the last days, that is, the times in which they were living was right at the ending of the night where the demonic was still in control, largely of history. The day, the second coming of Christ, the great eschaton was about to come. There's lots in the New Testament that would have us to live on tiptoe, that would have us to recognize that we don't know the future, and therefore it seems like to me that we've got to take seriously several things. One, Jesus says very clearly that nobody knows when this is going to happen. He himself didn't know it, though he was the incarnate Son of God. Only the Father had the timetable. In his mind, nobody knows for sure when it's going to come. He warned us against the false prophets who would be trying to manipulate us by saying, here is when it is bound to happen. Some of those tragic accounts in all history are utterly sincere people who have been led to think that they have been given to know when the second coming is going to occur. The last really big experience of that in this country was in 1849 when a group of people called Millerites gathered around a man named Miller. He specified a certain date. He instructed these people to sell all their property. He got them to put on white robes and even climb up on the top of barns because that would make them closer, you know, to see Christ as he appeared. He was to have come at dawn on a given day in 1849. And literally thousands of people gathered in upstate New York to witness this event. And that has happened again and again and again. And they always go home to the jeers of the drunkards, you know, who are out there to watch them. But they always, up to this point, those who have been too specific have always gone home to the jeers and to their own disappointments. I don't think that any of us know the exact hour and day when this is going to happen. Does that mean then that this whole apocalyptic spirit is of no use? No. I think the whole meaning back and the whole significance of the apocalyptic frame of mind is to intensify our concern for the things that are most important. Now, in pro football, they have a strategy for the last 2 minutes. In other words, when it becomes clear that the time is about to run out and if there's still any possibility of pulling it out, then the two-minute strategy, instead of people saying, well, there's just 2 minutes left, I might as well give up and quit, 2 minutes calls forth the most intense commitment to the principles that pertain to the process. I think the proper use of the apocalyptic expectation that this may happen before you get home from this Ridgecrest conference, it may happen before this Bible study is over. I think it is very valid to live with the kind of intensity that comes with the sense that we don't have forever, that we don't know the future, and therefore we need to be about the things that are most important. There is something about an emergency that clarifies life. It organizes things. It gives us some perspective of what to do. If it was suddenly announced that this building was on fire, and you and I knew that we had just a few minutes safely to get out of here, this would really serve to organize our activities. We would have one agenda, and that would be as quickly and with as much dispatch as possible to make it out of here. It would serve to call us out of our lethargy and out of our boredom, and we'd really have an objective. The people who lived through the London Blitz now talk about it as some of their finest hours, because everybody in London knew what they had to do. They were under a great stress. It organized existence for them. So what I would say to you is that take seriously that Christ really is at work, and that we don't have forever. Draw a great sense of hope from what I think is the eschatological framework, and that is that history is a story, it does have a plot, it does have a purpose, and as C.S. Lewis says, when the author appears on the stage, you know that the play is over. If you've ever been to a drama where the author happened to be there, the curtain comes down, and the author comes out, and you know when that happens that the drama has come to its rightful conclusion. And let me say that I really do think that Christ will come back. I really do think history is going somewhere. I really do think this cosmos is going to come to some kind of climax. I don't think it's just going to peter out and go into the frozenness that is sometime predicted scientifically. I really do think that what God has started, He is going to bring to the best possible conclusion that He's capable of. And when He's going to bring it to an end, we do not know. But that He is going to bring it to an end, I feel very certain of. Therefore, if this be the case, then the more diligent I can be about doing the things that pertain to what is being asked of me, that the busier I can be getting in touch with my gift love, and the busier I can be in doing faithfully what I've been given to do, according to lots of the parables of Jesus, that's the thing to be emphasized. Being found faithful, doing the things that were given you to do, and let the knowledge that it might be tomorrow, and let the knowledge that you don't know, serve to intensify your commitment rather than to undo it or undermine it. As St. Paul in other letters had to write to some people who, because they thought they were living in the last days, had done like the Millerites. That is, they pulled out of all the normal processes of life. They gave up, and they were just sitting around waiting for it to happen. Now, that's the very opposite of what I think apocalyptic is meant to call forth in us. It is to call us to intensity rather than to make us say, what's the use? Why fool with anything? If it's going to be over very soon, then I'll just give up and let it be over for me now. That is a perversion of apocalyptic thought. So St. Paul here is saying that he thinks that the end is very close, and he calls on these, therefore, and uses the images of night and day to walk in the light, as is often spoken of in the Scripture. It seems like to me, be as transparent and open to use the weapons of light means to use the weapons of love as over against the weapons of destruction. To walk in the light, it seems like to me, is to be as open and upfront and as candid with each other as we can for our own growth and our own healing. I went to an evangelism conference several years ago and was sitting by a seminary classmate of mine, and a particular leader of our denomination was speaking. And to be perfectly honest, the speaker really was playing to the gallery that afternoon. He was saying things that he knew these people wanted to hear. Rumor had it that he had aspirations for a high office that these people's approval could not have hurt him in getting. And so he was really giving them what they wanted to hear, and he was doing it well, and they were tearing their shirts and throwing dust in the air and were really liking it very much. And after it was over, my seminary colleague turned to me absolutely furious and said, you know, that just gripes the heck out of me, that guys like that who know better, you know, that's not what he really believes. That's not what he thinks is most important. You know, he was simply doing this for manipulation. And he was really giving the man who had spoken down the country, and we walked on out, and he was continuing to deliver himself of this. And in the midst of this kind of diatribe, guess who we bumped into face to face? The speaker, the guy who had just done the thing that my friend was so upset about. And I could hardly believe my eyes. It was almost as if we had shifted. My friend reaches out and shakes this guy's hand and says, great job, really hit a home run, really good to see you again. And then we walked up the street, and I said to him, not to be judgmental, but I said, you know, I said, I don't think what just happened is what the Bible calls walking in the light. I said, if in fact the man that you talked about is guilty of what you have charged, he really ought to be confronted about that. Somebody ought to say, look, I see through what you're doing, and I don't think that's what meetings like this are for. And if you're using this to get something for yourself that's exploitive, if the man were in fact doing that, then he had a right for his own growing to be confronted lovingly by a brother. If that were not what he were doing, in other words, if that really was what the man believed and he was honestly giving his gifts, then my friend needed to find that out and realize that he had not understood this fellow and therefore modify his perceptions. Either way, it seems like to me, some growth toward reality could have occurred if there had been a walking in the light. But it seems like to me that was walking in darkness, because this man did not take responsibility for what he was feeling toward a brother and take it to him and have out and resolve it. And as a result, the guy who spoke had the misconception that this man thought that he approved what he did. My friend had the rather futile experience of just getting angry at somebody but not doing anything about it. Okay, the weapons of darkness are this kind of devious, manipulative, feeling one thing but saying another. You know, those of us who are children of the South have been steeped in this culture of niceness where you just always smile and always say something positive. And I can remember as a child going to visit my father's people, and they would be sitting around the afternoon, and here would come a neighbor up the sidewalk to visit, and they would say, "What on earth are they doing here?" And you'd be flying around the room and getting everything straight, obviously annoyed at this intrusion. But then the person comes to the door, and it's all sweetness and light. "Oh, I'm so glad to see you. Come in, sit down, do all of this pleasant interacting." The person leaves, and they say, "Did you see what she had on? Can you imagine her coming over here?" And as a child, I was profoundly confused by this Southern way of life that obviously felt one way out of somebody's presence, but in their presence was altogether different. We are never going to have authentic community if we don't get up front. Now, that doesn't mean you vent your bile on everybody that you feel. I don't have to live out of my feelings, though I do have to feel my feelings, I think, to be healthy. But to walk in the light is to take what I'm honestly feeling and what my resources are and give them to you in a way that gives you a chance to respond, gives you a way to explain to me that maybe the way I'm seeing you is not the way you really are. I think when we assault people, we don't give them a chance to give us their story because many times we do misunderstand. But walking in the light or using the weapons of light is really being upfront and clear and direct in our loving. Our time is just about out. The 14th chapter is a very significant chapter about how to relate to a weaker brother or sister. I like the way C.S. Lewis sums up what I think is the principle here, and that is, let the person who doesn't have a scruple about something be sensitive to the person who does. If something is not a problem for you, but you sense that it really is a significant problem for somebody else, then the fact that it is a problem for them ought to be factored in as you decide what you're doing. Let me underline the fact, though, that the person that we're talking about here is the beginner in the faith, the brother who is beginning and is weak. This does not mean that every neurotic person that comes along, that you have to bend and shape your life just because they are dissatisfied with everything. This business about if meat caused my brother to stumble, I will eat no meat. It all depends what kind of brother it is that you're dealing with. If it is a beginner in the faith, if it is somebody that is earnestly trying to learn and to grow, and for you to do something that could be honestly misinterpreted and therefore cause that person problems, then in the name of Christian responsibility, I think we have a reason to be careful. But there are some neurotic people who don't like anything that if you took this literally, you couldn't even get out of bed in the morning because there's somebody that's not going to like anything you do, that's going to twist everything out of shape. Therefore, I do think that the principle, that the person who doesn't have any scruples about something should be sensitive to the person who does. If it's not a problem for me and it is for you, then Christian charity calls on me to make allowance for that and to do what I can not to complicate your situation. But please know that the first verse of the 14th chapter says, "Except among you the man who is weak in the faith, the beginner." This is not talking about some of these people who have gotten so curdled in their relationship to life that no matter what you do, they're going to find something wrong. Don't sell out your existence. Don't let those people give you your grade. Don't let those kind of people be your audience. Let the people for whom you have a chance really to help and to grow, let those be the people who you take into focus as you're deciding what it is that you do with your power. Well, you never get through anything in history. You never do anything perfectly. This has been bumbling, stumbling, lots of Claypool, and hopefully a sum of St. Paul in the Epistle to the Romans. But as you go, please, please remember, you are the delightful creation of a gift-love God. You don't have to do anything to make him love you any more than he loves you at this very moment. There is nothing you can do to keep him from loving you. Life is not a spelling bee, one mistake and you're out. But life is the everlasting process of a joyful God trying to get us into the party and to teach us how to dance. So go enjoy.